If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies, movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them, movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks, classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 92. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around, it's the Newton Mass special. Yes, I don't do Christmas, and instead it's Newton Mass, which is the holiday that celebrates information, and we give gifts of information and knowledge. So this is going to be an extra special episode, kind of like those ones, those after-school specials. I've got a friend of mine, Paul Poulton, on the line, and he, I've been promising to get onto the podcast for about 2 years, and we're finally here. How you doing, Paul?
Good. And yourself, Terry?
Yeah, pretty good. It's going well here. I've got a functioning kitchen, and I just finished making strawberry ice cream for sale. Awesome. So it's all good. Yeah, I've got a $20 ice cream maker from Aldi, and I've made really excellent strawberry ice cream with it, surprisingly enough, because ice cream makers, the scam of ice cream makers is that an ice cream maker is just basically this bucket that you put in the freezer, and the only bit of it that you really need to buy is a paddle on a motor to sit on the top of it and spin around, and that's exactly what an ice cream maker does. I didn't know this because I thought, I'll get an ice cream maker, maybe it freezes itself. It doesn't. You got to jam it in the freezer for 8 hours before you make ice cream.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it does come out very, very good when you do it.
No, I had some friends of mine they brought along an ice cream maker to a picnic we were at about February or something, and yep. Yes, having homemade ice cream at a picnic was just like, wow.
I suppose you could do it with the hand churn ones and all that kind of thing, but this one you need to plug in. It's got a little digital readout on the top and all that sort of thing. But it came out fantastically well, so I'm going to experiment. I'm going to be doing – I might even do beer-flavored ice cream at some stage if I'm feeling a bit silly. Who knows? I'll get a bit of a duck.
Get into the spirits. You know, you get your whiskey and your strawberry liqueur or cherry liqueur or whatever.
Frangelico ice cream. I could get
it. Yeah. That'll
I could
work.
Definitely go for Angelica. But anyway, we're going to get into you rather than me. Sorry about that. Okay, here we go. Basically, you are really big on costuming and steampunk, so let the people know a little bit about how you got into it and what you do.
Yeah, I have always had, I suppose I've always had a fascination with history in general, the Victorian era in particular. Just always loved the fashion side of things, and always been interested in science fiction. You know, I think I was 10 when Star Wars came out. Don't laugh. And seeing sort of the Victorian era and the science fiction era converge into a, you know, I mean, we've always had things kicking around like, you know, the George Powell's Time Machine was always one of my favourite movies, the old Disney 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and all those sort of the 19th century novels made into films. But now we're seeing this whole new explosion of Victorian science fiction. And yeah, it's moved from an obscure underground genre that only a few people knew about to now having conventions of their own and turning up as in references in things like the New York Times and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the steampunk thing really has kicked it in big. Have you seen Hugo yet, the Scorsese movie?
I haven't seen it, no. I've seen the trailer for it.
Looks good. I'm looking forward to that myself.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to that one.
And I was going to get you on to do a couple of movies that are kind of slightly steampunky in their own ways, but we're going to do that probably in February now. We'll do The Great Race with Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis, and we're going to do The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, both of which have big steampunk parts to them. So that should be a bit of fun, and just to foreshadow it for the punters out there.
Yeah, looking forward to those.
So what have you been watching lately in movies?
Of late, I've been, apart from doing some TV stuff, hunting up TV bits and pieces, I've been doing a bit of an 80s fantasy fest.
Not porn films?
No. Yeah. The last three that I watched, we had Beastmaster.
Okay, Mark Singer.
Mark Singer, yes. Krull.
I saw that on Foxtel a little while ago. Geez, that's clumsy and stilted.
I had forgotten quite a lot that was in it, and although you know you're looking in the cast and it's got Alan Armstrong, Liam Neeson's in it, and you're just going, all these magnificent people, and you screwed it up so badly.
Have you seen Liam Neeson lately? I saw him in. I watched The A-Team again. And he's got this really weird facial configuration now. He kind of looks like Hawkman does when he wears the mask. You have a look at a profile shot of Liam Neeson, and he didn't used to look like that, but now he's got this really weird kind of Hawkman.
Maybe he's been getting into the Botox.
I'm not sure whether it's Botox. I think that somebody must have slammed both sides of his face into a door.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really weird thing. And once I noticed that when I was watching The A-Team, I couldn't notice anything but that. As you do when you notice something weird. But, so anything else you've been watching?
The one after that was Hawk the Slayer, which was another 80s one.
Jack Palance, yeah.
Yeah, who lots of people love Jack Palance. I am not one of them.
Okay, fair enough. We've got a question about favourite actors and least favourite actors a bit later, so I'll just foreshadow.
And I've done my annual Christmas movie.
Die Hard?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes. For the first time, I've lost count of how many times I've actually watched this. Yep. And for the first time watching it this weekend, the Nakatomi Corporation symbol came up, and I've just gone, you know, that's like a stylized samurai helmet. How the hell did I not notice this before?
Yeah, I actually looked it up. You know what Nakatomi means?
No?
In Japanese, wealth within.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which was the whole thing about them going into the vault.
Yes.
It's a basically multilingual in-joke.
Cute.
Yeah. So, yeah, Die Hard, definitely. I've got a big fondness of Die Hard. I once won $500 on a bet about Die Hard.
Oh, nice.
Back when it first came out, yeah, there was this charter airline pilot or something that was at a party when I was living in Canberra who thought he knew everything, and it turns out he didn't. So I had a very good night out nightclubbing that night on this guy's money. But anyway, yeah, so I'll let people know what I've been watching a bit. I haven't watched too much because I only did the podcast about a week ago. I'm recording this a week early and it'll be sent off just before I go on my drive up to Sydney. I saw this movie from the 1960s called The Honey Pot, which has Rex Harrison and Maggie Smith in it and a bunch of other things, Capuchin's in it and... who else was in there? Not Rita Hayworth, but basically it's a really weird kind of thing. It starts out like a French farce because it's all in Venice and it's got kind of grandiose palazzos and all sorts of things like that. It starts out like a French farce where a wealthy gentleman basically gets three of his exes to come to his little palace in Venice by telling them that he's dying. It's basically Volpone. Done as a modern thing. But the weird thing is that it turns into a murder mystery half the way through. It's got Cliff Robertson in it. It's a really weird movie, but it's got a young Maggie Smith in it when she was very sexy. And she does a really good job of this kind of dog's breakfast of a movie, being the heart of the film in a lot of ways. And, yeah, it's kind of interesting. I picked it up for $5 in a little stall. You know how in the middle of shopping centres they have those temporary stalls they set up selling?
You get the grab bags.
Yeah, remote control helicopters and other shit like that. This one, they happen to have a couple of DVDs there, so I picked up that. And what else did I see? I saw the new Conan the Barbarian movie, the 2011 one.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Which is not too bad right up until the end when it turns into an animatic for a computer game.
With the man boobs bloke from Game of Thrones.
I'm not sure, but I think so, yeah.
Yes. Yeah,
Jason Momoa or something like that. But, yeah, it doesn't do too badly until at the end it turns into one of those things where you got to kill the boss monster at the end of a computer game.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit lacking.
I was going to say, I'm sure there's a computer game linked to it that if it isn't out already, it will be by Christmas.
Yeah, I think it's source material, apart from the Robert E. Howard stuff. It kind of does have a source material from computer games. It's got very much, the action sequences are framed the way computer game action sequences are, a little too much, which I kind of think knocks things in the arse a bit. I did see Ronin as well, the John Frankenheimer film starring Robert De Niro.
Oh, yes.
Jean Reno and that. Got the best
I quite like that.
It's got the best car chases ever. They got the best people in the world to do it, which was Equipage Remy Julien, a French mob who did the Italian job apart from anything else. Yeah. And they ripped the shit out of every frigging road in Paris, a whole bunch down in the south of France, and the car chases are terrific. There's no CGI in this. This is 98, so there's no CGI stuff.
No, it's I've actually watched it a couple of times. It's I quite like it.
Yeah, I picked it up on Blu-ray for $10, so I thought it was well worth doing. And, it's one of those films where you can visit it every couple of years and just enjoy the action sequences. I think it's not one of De Niro's best roles. He kind of underplays it a little bit. Gives it what it's got. Jean Reno, of course, steals any movie he's in, so that's a good thing. And
I think it was one of Sean Bean's first movie roles, sort of going from TV to film.
Yeah, he always seems to play, I mean, apart from Game of Thrones and things like that, he always seems to play assholes.
Somebody actually put together, there was a YouTube clip, and it's all of the death scenes that Sean Bean has done from movies and TV shows, and it's, killing Sean Bean or something like that, and it's about 7 minutes long, and there's all those death scenes every time he's been killed off.
There's a particularly good one in the first part of the Red Riding trilogy as well. Which, if you haven't seen it, I'd recommend it. It's three TV movies done by British TV recently, and they are
I think I've seen the first one, but I haven't seen the other two.
I haven't seen the other two either yet. I haven't had time to get around to them. I've got the three on DVD, but solid stuff, definitely. So I watched Ronin. I saw a documentary today, which was on Studio on Foxtel, called Cinema's Exiles from Hitler to Hollywood, which is about all of the emigre movie actors and technicians and directors and writers and cinematographers who left Europe when Hitler took over in the 1930s and populated Hollywood and enriched Hollywood. Casablanca, just about everybody on the screen apart from Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman, is an emigre exile.
Yeah.
The Nazis. And it's a really nice little documentary. It runs about an hour and 20 minutes, but it's dead solid. Apparently there were 800 of them came over to Hollywood. From UFA and then from the Austrian film industry and then from the French film industry.
Yeah, there was a couple of waves there was a big group that came over in about 1934.
With Peter Lorre amongst them and people like that. Peter Lorre, Billy Wilder, Fritz Lang and all those sort of people. And they spent their first year in Hollywood learning to speak English by reading comic books and other things like that, and talking to people. And they were under horrible restrictions too. Some of them didn't have citizenship or any kind of permanent residency. So a number of them had a curfew imposed on them, so they couldn't go out at 8 o'clock at night. They couldn't make connections at those Hollywood parties to get jobs and things. And there's one guy, I forget his name, but he was on an 8 p.m. restriction. So Charles Laughton and Elsa Lanchester used to come around to his house every night at 8 o'clock and spend the evening with him so he wouldn't be lonely. And Lawton would do recitations from Shakespeare and things like that.
Wow.
And they'd sing music hall songs and just make this guy feel incredibly welcome at a time when his life was restricted by these stupid immigration laws. It's just a fantastic little documentary if people can find it. And I suppose you could find a torrent or something, but really nicely done. I also saw Heavy Metal, the animated movie from the 80s.
God.
It's really weird. I mean, the animation's very, very rudimentary, but it's got voice acting by people like John Candy and Eugene Levy, which makes things a little bit weird. And there's like every time there's a female character in there, she gets naked.
Yeah.
And they've got these.
I think I saw that. I don't think I've seen it since it's been actually released. After it came out in the cinema, but I have seen it. But it's been years.
Yeah, it's really weird too because
that was Ralph Bakshi involved with that?
I think he was because there's a lot of Bakshi-like animation.
Yeah, yeah.
They did a lot from the Metal Hurlant comic book magazine that came out, which was in the English edition. It was Heavy Metal.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that kind of stuff in there. Lots of animated female pubes in there as well because they've got, like, if a chick's got green hair, she's got green pubes, and if a chick's got white hair, she's got white pubes. But there's always pubes, and none of the women are less than buxom. It's really kind of a 13-year-old boy's fantasy idea of what
it... This was, late 70s, early 80s?
Very early 80s. I'll check that, but I think it was very early.
You hadn't quite got into Brazilians for...
But it's nice to see. It's kind of like watching a 85th generation copy of a porn film. But, 1981, it was Canadian, actually, the film. And, it was on TCM, of all things, on Foxtel. And so I recorded and watched that. Didn't like any of the music because it's all heavy metal stuff, which isn't really my gig. But interesting to just see the rotoscoping on the animation and how they try to overcome the limitations at the time of budget and the ability to do animation in a quick turnaround time. But, it was a bit of fun. I haven't been watching anything else much apart from that. But, it's a nice little bit. There's lots of cheap DVDs and Blu-rays around at the moment.
Do you get into television at all with some of your genre stuff?
Yeah, I watch Fringe.
Right, yes.
Yeah, do a bit of Fringe. What else? I'm getting a few episodes of Grimm. I've been hearing good things about Grimm.
Don't know Grimm.
Well, it's basically, that all of Grimm's fairy tales are true and they've got people who hunt the monsters, family.
Interesting.
I've
just been, I think last week, a friend of mine put me onto a show called Once Upon a Time.
I've heard about that, but I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I've watched the first two episodes of that, and I'm quite enjoying it. It's got a nice dark edge to it.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like Sondheim's Into the Woods in a way, that's the problem. There's too many things and not enough time, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm kind of doing this thing. I did movies about Dr. Mabuse, German crimi films, in the last podcast. So I've been catching up on German crimi films, which I found out are less good to watch than a lot of other films because normally I browse the web while I'm watching a movie, and you can't do that with subtitle films.
No,
I've got to uneducate myself to multitask.
You've got to pay attention. So what did that? Hang on, what happened? Yes.
Yeah, so I've got a little bit of that, so I'm getting into that a little bit. I'm going to have a break from movies, obviously, because I'm driving up to Sydney for Christmas and spending a little time with the family and things like that. But when I get back, I've got a few days spare, and I'll catch up on things then. But, it's an interesting time. And the radio gig, I'm not sure whether I mentioned it in the last podcast, but you know about me doing the radio with ABC Radio. Yeah, they're doing it again next year.
Oh, good stuff.
And they had the guys in charge of, high-up guy in ABC Radio who actually bothered to listen to one of our episodes where Ivor, Cole and I talk about movies on the radio. And I got some incredibly positive feedback about that. Like, this guy is a good broadcaster. Keep him doing what he's doing.
Excellent.
Yeah, which surprised the shit out of me. It's kind of like a third act in my life almost doing this kind of thing, and I really like doing it.
Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, so having a bit of fun with that as well.
Star eyes, that's the way you make my eyes shine.
when those lips of yours caress mine, just to have you by my side would leave me starry eyes, lonely eyes you put a dream in, eyes that only you're supreme in. Don't you know it's just for you? They sparkle as they do, though the stars aren't real. I know they show how much I care. Tell me how it makes you feel to know you put them there. Star eyes, when, if ever, will your heart know that it's you for whom these eyes glow? Makes no difference where you are. My eyes will hold your wishing star. So kiss me and wish on a star. Though the stars aren't real, I know they show how much I care. Tell me how it makes you feel to know you put them there. Star eyes, when, if ever, will your heart know that it's you for whom these eyes glow? Makes no difference where you are. My eyes will hold your wishing star. So kiss me and wish on a star.
So I'm going to go into these questions that I've got for you,
right,
just to getting to know you kind of thing.
Okay.
Now, there's a TV show which you might not see on Foxtel called Inside the Actor's Studio, where James Lipton interviews everybody in the movie industry, basically actors, directors, all sorts of shit. And he's got these 10 questions he asks based on 10 questions that were done 30 or 40 years ago by a French TV interviewer called Bernard Pivot. So this is like third generation questions you're getting here.
The carbon copy of the carbon copy.
It is. And so I'm going to go into the first one. Who's your favourite actor and why?
Ooh.
Or actress, doesn't matter.
There's a few that I follow that, you know, I'll go and see stuff that I suppose he's the cinema draw card. Mm-hmm. Probably I'd say the one that's had a lasting influence would be, sure, Kenneth Branagh. He actually helped. I used to have an absolute loathing for Shakespeare because so many people take the Shakespeare story as the historical story. And, you know, it's like sort of when you see a movie on TV, you know, based on real events, and when you then go and see the real events, you know how far it's not actual, the thing.
Yeah.
Which Shakespeare is like that. And I sort of had this thing, because people used to do that, I disliked Shakespeare and I had difficulty seeing the story just for the story. And yeah, with Branagh's reinterpretations of Shakespeare and sort of bringing that into cinema again, that a lot of that helped me overcome my distaste of it and actually could appreciate them just for the stories that they were.
Yeah, I like Brandon Shakespeare as well. My favourite one's actually Much Ado About Nothing. I really like the kind of Tuscany setting and then the exuberance of it. It brings that love of Shakespeare in.
And even, you know, some of his other stuff. I mean, the Shackleton thing that he did, you know, his guest spot in one of the Harry Potter movies. So, you know, he can do... I think he ought to try and do a bit more comedy, but yeah.
Yeah, well, it's the opportunities thing. I even liked his Thor. I mean, I think it worked really well.
Yeah,
but it's totally different from the other Marvel films. Yeah,
him in the director's seat. Yeah, it's quite a. And I mean, I'm not a big comics fan, so you know, I don't know. Yeah, I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that'll be going, "Oh, wasn't this?"
Yeah.
But certainly as a movie, I thought, yeah, it was quite entertaining. So, yeah, it's good.
I think it worked well. I think getting Anthony Hopkins to play Thor, though, was a bit of a cliche in a way. I'm sure there are a number of other actors they could have got who would have been equally as good, but I don't think Hopkins brought his A-game to that one.
No, probably not. But, you know, I suppose it's, again, sometimes you go for the actor recognition rather than the brand recognition rather than the quality of the performance that they've put in.
Yeah, they should have got Brian Blessed or someone. That would have been great.
I don't know if you've heard it. Do you know what a TomTom is?
Like a
GPS brand?
GPS TomTom, yeah.
There's a mate of mine in the UK as part of a group. They've got it done finally. Brian Blessed doing a TomTom voice.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Mm.
Yeah, that'd be very bossy.
Yes. No, turn left. So,
no, that's great. I mean, that was the weird thing about computer voices in the past too, in old movies. You either had a sexy female voice or you had a very effeminate gay voice. Yeah, you know, like Hard to Do D2 being the big example of that one with the kind of effeminate voices and that kind of thing. But having an honestly masculine voice, I mean, yeah. But yeah, having Robert Mitchum do your GPS would be great too. You know,
yeah,
if you turn left, you want to, I don't care. That kind of thing. But yeah, it's interesting what people are doing with technology now and who they're getting to do it with. But yeah, so that was the first question. So we've got Kenny Branagh, always good value. Mm-hmm. What else did I see him that I really like? Dead Again. I saw Dead Again recently with him and Emma.
Oh, yeah.
Not a bad little film. Who's your least favourite actor and why? You can make a list if you need to.
I mean, there's a lot of sort of, I don't know, C-list half actors that, I mean, you know, the Rock, he's good at what he does, but he can't act.
Yeah, I think that's more a description of his acting role ability than anything else.
Will Smith, I find very overrated.
I find him very annoying. I think he's smug. He's got to that age where a lot of actors, leaving aside race or anything like that, get a certain gravitas to them, and they get a certain ability to project. Yeah, I know. But just generally, I think Will Smith plays to the audience too much, as an actor.
I think he can act, certainly, you know, what was the one? Enemy of the State, I thought was a brilliant movie, but he far too often, he'll try for the smooth, you know, try the suave, smooth character that I don't think he can pull off.
He's a bit of a smartass. Anybody else?
I'm trying to think. No.
Well, we'll go to the next question.
Yeah, we can do that.
Okay, what turned you on in a movie? I mean, but leaving aside the obvious. You know, what things when you see in a movie?
The ones where you, I mean, yeah, having a decent script. I know it's one of those lame things, but it's so friggin' hard to get now.
Mm-hmm. It's a script by committee almost, isn't it?
I saw a trailer and I commented to somebody and I said, if we ever needed proof that Hollywood has run out of fresh ideas, this is it. And it's the remake of the Three Stooges movie.
Yeah, I saw that and I thought, why?
So, yeah. But, things that I love a good thriller. So something that will get you going, not so much scare you with the cheap jump out of the bushes and go boo.
Yeah.
But a good something that will build the tension. Seven is a perfect example of that. They show you enough things just to get your head going, what the hell? But there's no, you don't actually ever see anyone committing any of the crimes. You don't see inside the box.
Yeah.
None of that sort of stuff. And it's all suggestion, just enough to get your head starting to screw with it.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I like that one. What turns you off in a movie, apart from people with the cell phones and things?
People in cinemas with cell phones. Jingoism.
Okay. The American flag waving thing?
It's like, if it wasn't for you, if it wasn't for us, you'd all be speaking German sort of thing. It's just, piss off.
Yeah, that's the thing that pisses me off with that kind of stuff too, is everybody says that French people are surrender monkeys.
Yeah.
All you got to do is look at the history of the resistance and go, no, they're fucking tough, but it's just they were overwhelmingly beaten by a superior military force and then they turned around to try to fuck them up every way they could until the Allies got involved.
Yeah.
No, that's a good, another good one. Okay, so what's your favourite cliche in a movie? Which one do you actually don't mind too much?
Cars being able to car chase after they've, you go over a speed bump in real life at sort of 30 Ks and you can hear the scraping as it's torn something off. And then, the car chase you'll go over a bridge, down some stairs, you'll run into another car or something and off we keep going. And you sitting there, you're going, nah, couldn't do that. But it's good.
Yeah, one of the worst things I saw was I got passed when I was in a taxi in Sydney by a Porsche. Porsche Carrera at the time was like late 80s, early 90s. And there was a new roundabout just around the curve, and the Porsche went over the centre of the roundabout and through the concrete. And it was really lovely because it landed right on the other side of it, and there was this beautiful gush of steam coming out at a really strange angle from the radiator. It wasn't looking very good at all.
Would have ripped out brake lines, coolant lines, and just about everything else.
Yeah, pretty much. And the guy was standing beside it just looking at it. But what's your least favourite cliche in movies?
I was going to say explosions, but I still like my explosions. You know, I know if you throw a grenade into a house, it should only go boom and you get shrapnel, not actually blow up the whole house.
Yeah.
The Hollywood grenade. I don't know. I suppose it's where you move into the suspension of disbelief. You can push. I remember making a comment about when the first Mission Impossible movie came out.
Yeah.
And I said, there was things like, flying the helicopter through the channel. And I'm just going, no. But as I said to somebody else, had it been a James Bond movie, I would have gone, yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm actually going to see the new Mission Impossible film, not for Tom Cruise, but because I kind of like Dubai as a setting. I've been there, and I really like it. And it's got a few other actors in it that I'm interested in, like Simon Pegg and Jeremy Renner. But not really seeing it for Tom Cruise, because I think Tom Cruise has jumped the shark in the weirdness stakes. He's just got to that point where nobody has said no to him for about 20, 30 years, and he starts believing his own publicity.
Yeah, I think he probably needs a couple more no men kicking around. I mean, Valkyrie, despite not doing particularly well at the box office, I actually thought was a very good film. I don't know. I suppose it's one of those things that you've really got to do. What did he do since then? I don't think he's done.
He did a really bad one called Night and Day with Cameron Diaz, which I watched.
Right.
Yes. I saw that with Jamie and Sarah.
Yeah.
And we were just sitting there going, how many different ways is this wrong?
Yeah.
It was just nightmarishly bad.
I suppose if you get a couple of good movies, then people will forgive the weird shit going on in the background.
Yeah, I'm not sure they do, because I think that his weirdness infects the movies. Now, he's trying to play 25-year-old guy at his age in a lot of these films. And, yeah, the guy's hitting 50 now, and you've got to kind of take it in a different direction at that stage. Bruce Willis has done it. He makes fun of his action heroes as much as
he was talking about. I saw an interview with him last month before. They're talking about a Die Hard 5, and I'm just going, I don't know.
Yeah,
I like Die Hard 4, but really, you're pushing the age barrier there, Bruce.
Yeah, well, he's playing the original G.I. Joe in the new G.I. Joe movie, but I think he's taking the piss out of himself in that. I've seen the trailer for it.
Oh, okay, no, I haven't seen
it. I wasn't impressed with the last G.I. Joe movie, but I think with Bruce Willis in it, taking the mickey out of himself, I think it may just actually be worth watching, maybe downloading it illegally, not paying for it in any way, but downloading it illegally. But so next question: what's your favourite swear word? And you can say anything on this podcast that's adult rated.
Bollocks.
Okay, bollocks works.
It's enough of a thing that a lot of people will then go, "You what?"
Yeah, particularly if they're from America or somewhere like that, it's not really widely there. It's something that Anglophiles will understand, but not much else. But, okay, here's the next one. Now, I've made this one up because the other ones weren't appropriate, the ones for the actors. If you worked in the movie industry, what job would you most like to have?
Ooh. I know when I was in high school, I really, really wanted to get into special effects.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I used to build models and all that sort of stuff. And I think at the time, what was it? The last Starfighter came out.
First movie with really good CGI.
Well, first movie with CGI.
Yeah, crazy.
And it was all, you know, 8-bit, whatever it was. And I can remember as a young, naive teenager that I was, looking at it and going, computer graphics, if that's the best they can do, who's going to want that?
It's not the best I can do now.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, what we can do now, shit's all over that. But, I always used to love doing the models and things. Probably costuming would be another one. But, that sort of, I suppose, set dressing, for want of a better...
Okay, so basically set design and things like that.
Yeah, so helping get the look of a film. So, art production or whatever you want to call it.
Sure. Okay, here's the next question, which is fairly obviously. If you worked in the film industry, what job would you least like to have apart from fluffer?
Is it embarrassing that I know what that is? No.
No, it's not. You're just well read.
I don't know. Being a PA for somebody, you know, for an assistant director or something, that had got to be one of the most thankless jobs.
Mm.
You know, your general dog's body for somebody who's trying to, you know, coax everybody else's ego.
A metaphysical fluffer.
Almost.
Okay, that's fair enough. Okay, and here's the last question, which is a paraphrase of James Lipton's one. If God existed, which religiously themed movie would he or she or it most be ashamed of?
Oh... The Golden Child.
Fair enough. I would have gone with the Mel Gibson one, but
I don't know. I mean, there's so many. Oh. I mean, we've of course, getting onto this time of year, people will drag out the Ten Commandments and Greatest Story Ever Told and all that sort of stuff. And
yeah, I mean, Ben-Hur's another one they drag out too.
Yeah, Ben-Hur.
Am I totally silly to think that I would have rather had Stephen Boyd win that chariot race because he was much cooler?
I was reading something the other day about somebody asked Kevin Smith about a possible Dogma sequel.
Mm.
And he actually said that, you know, when they first made Dogma, he said, wouldn't have even thought about making a sequel, but he said, you know, the way that the all the debate on intelligent design and all this other sort of, and whether, you know, climate change is man-made or whether it's, you know, God's justice for homosexuality or something.
Homosexuality just happened?
I was going to say that's probably something I'll talk about you. Okay. Talk with you off air or something. Or,
okay, cool. Sounds fine.
It's a Stephen Colbert thing.
Okay.
He was saying that, you know, the way things are all going with all this stuff recently, he said he would almost be tempted to try and get another Dogma sequel going. So.
Yeah, the worst thing in Dogma was Alan Rickman with no crotch. That really pissed off a lot of women I know who are very, very big on Alan Rickman.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for answering those ones. So I'll tell you what, we'll take a break and let you get a drink if you haven't got one.
All right.
And we'll come back and we'll do another little bit.
We don't have no lovings in El Paso. We don't swap our wives with our neighbors, and we keep our kids away from Mexico. And I'm proud to be an asshole from El Paso. Tacos. And the wetbacks still get 20 cents an hour. We don't wipe our asses on Old Glory. God and Lone Star beer are things we trust. We keep our women virgins till they're married. So hoes and sheep is good enough for us. And I'm proud to be an asshole from El Paso. Place where sweet young virgins are deflowered. You walk down the street deep in tacos. And the wetbacks still get 20 cents an hour. I'm proud to be an asshole from El Paso. Place with sweet young virgins on your flower. You walk down that street knee deep in tacos. And the wetbacks still get 20 cents an hour.
And we're back, and I've chucked some music in there, but I don't know which music I've chucked in yet because I'm still recording here with Paul. Okay, about those movies, Krull and things like that. Tell us a little bit about what you got from re-watching them after two or three decades.
Yeah, well, I think they're like 81, 82 releases. Beastmaster, I think, still stands up as a movie. It's, you know, it's that sort of stereotypical desert movie, very similar to the Conan, which I think came out the same year.
82, I think, yeah.
Yeah, visually, they're very similar. Sadly, you know, Mark Singer never really went on to do much after that. I mean, he was in the V miniseries, but not much.
I think he did a documentary recently about people who live underground in New York City. He actually produced and directed it.
Okay, yeah.
And it got a few nominations for awards.
Yeah.
So he's gone in that direction, yeah.
But yeah, you know, as a movie for the time, I think it still stands up. Mm-hmm. Krull was just a train wreck.
Absolutely.
Despite having, you know, people who are today recognised as some of the leading Hollywood actors, you know, Liam Neeson, Alan Armstrong. There was
Bernard Breslau was in it.
Yeah.
From the Carry On movies, playing the Cyclops.
Yeah. And I'm trying to remember what the actress was. Abigail? No. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
English actress,
mm-hmm,
in her first role, but because the lead actor was being played by an American, despite rest of the cast being all, you know, British actors, they dubbed her voice.
Was that Lisette Anthony?
Lisette Anthony, yes, yeah. They've dubbed her voice with an American actress.
Ooh.
Why? So, and Hawk the Slayer, which used to be sort of a bit of a staple back when I was part of a role-playing club. We'd do video days as part of our social thing. And I used to bag the shit out of it then, but it's, by comparison, I don't think it's a great movie, but it's held up better than I thought it would have.
Okay.
The none of the cast have gone onto anything sort of particularly big and spectacular. Jack Palance was in it, but I think my comment about his acting in this one was that he was being out-acted by the cardboard trees around him.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think his earlier roles, he did some fantastic earlier stuff.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, but, you know, he was certainly getting into, you know, the stereotypical cheesy villain, which, you know, that, I don't know how much of that was the material and how much of it was him, because I think one of his other films was his version of Dracula, which is another one that I... not a fan of. Despite that version probably being the most accurate to the books of any of them. I've watched those three, and I've got Dragon Slayer, which is sitting there sort of as the next one to watch. And I'm still, you know, for a movie that's now 30 years old, the dragons that they put up in Dragon Slayer, I've yet to seen bettered.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of things with Dragon Slayer that were interesting, one of which is it was a lot gorier than any other Disney film at the time.
Yes, yeah.
And there was a lot of guts in that. And it's got the absolute best, 100% the best, exploding Ralph Richardson in any movie ever. Never seen him explode better in a film.
No, yes.
But, I mean, well worth watching that stuff. Going back to the 80s stuff is always good. Going back to anything older, you kind of do get a perspective on things. I've been
Some of the 80s ones, you know, Willow, Lady Hawk, some of those ones. That was another thing I was going to mention with the Hawk the Slayer, was the music in it. Really sort of... it was almost dodgy late 70s electro flute, just very out of place, which sort of, it reminded me of the Lady Hawk soundtrack. Which,
that's what I was going to say. Lady Hawk's music is atrociously bad.
Yeah, just really out of place.
Was that Tangerine Dream or someone? I think it might have been.
Oh, I honestly couldn't tell you. But yeah, it was sort of that very, you know, funky sort of music. And I think there were two wars of soundtracks going on at the time, if you like. You know, we had the John Williamson sort of orchestral score versions going, and then other people going, no, we must have modern music. And, you know, thankfully the orchestral seems to have won out.
I think you meant John Williams there. John Williamson's an entirely different artist. It's not like an Australian bush ballad here.
I was going to say, not Old Man Emu to the Star Wars theme, yeah.
No, definitely not. But, John Williams is kind of... I'm trying to find modern composers. I'm kind of iffy about John Williams. I think he borrowed a lot from Korngold and Rocher and people like that, maybe too much. But I did like the stuff he did for Irwin Allen in the 1960s, like the theme from Land of the Giants and Lost in Space and that kind of stuff.
And I think, if you're writing... And I suppose you look at some of the classical composers of the time. Mozart was just prodigious, but, you know, say Beethoven, Tchaikovsky, things like that. You look at what they wrote and how much they wrote, and then you look at sort of the quantity of music that's being put out by somebody who has to do it for a film where you can't sort of turn around and say, oh, look, I don't feel like writing it today. I'll finish it tomorrow.
Yeah.
And movies released on, 2 weeks before Christmas or whatever, you've got to have it finished.
They did that all the way through the history of movies. I mean, the guys who wrote Laura, I talked about Laura a couple of podcasts ago.
Mm.
David Raxon had like 3 weeks to write the music for Laura.
Yeah. And you're writing under that sort of pressure. And I mean, I know a couple of people have made comments about James Horner, that he tends to, recycle little melody
motifs and things.
He'll put that one back in, and you hear that, and you go, oh. And I suppose even to an extent, recognizing someone like Danny Elfman, you hear one of his, and you go, oh, it's Danny Elfman.
Yeah.
But because they're writing under these, I suppose, extreme pressures of time space, that you only get so much that you can go, need a new melody, bugger it, I'll put this one in.
Yeah, and you've also got that thing where people like Elfman, and it doesn't matter who it is, they like certain instruments.
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of, you go, okay, that's Danny Elfman, he's got that instrument in it, or that's John Williams, he's got the brass is really big in it, or... Mm. Yeah, you've got Raxon who uses weird things like castanets in the background of odd little bits and pieces. And,
So,
and all that kind of stuff.
I suppose Jerry Goldsmith was one of the ones who I think probably had the broadest range, because, I couldn't sort of listen to a piece of his and go, oh, yep, that's Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the others, you listen to one of their soundtracks or one of their pieces of music and you go, oh, yep, that's so-and-so.
Talking about Goldsmith, the last radio thing I did before the holidays was in like Flint Now Man Flint.
Mm.
And we spent a bit of time talking about how good Jerry Goldsmith soundtracks for those were. Played a little bit of it in the background as well. And they
are. Back in the 60s when the bongo was considered a musical instrument.
It still is, but it shouldn't be overused. It's a bit like ghost chilies. It's okay to use a tiny bit of it, but don't use too much. I've got the two soundtracks for the Flint movies, and they're actually good background music, kind of thing.
I've got the first one,
They're very groovy, and they're very of their time without being dated, which is really a hard thing to pull off.
Yeah.
You can have something that's dated badly, like Tangerine Dream soundtracks, for instance. But there's other stuff that you go, okay, that's very listenable. I can put that on the background while I'm doing something else, and it's kind of groovy music for me.
I was going to say, as a perfect example, the movie Legend.
Mm. Yeah.
Speaking of Tom Cruise, no. Because when they re-edit, I've actually got a DVD that has both the US edit and the European edit, and it's almost like watching two different movies. The US edit had a Tangerine Dream soundtrack, and for the European release, they scrapped the Tangerine Dream one and got Jerry Goldsmith to compose the music. And just the difference in the music, the difference in the editing, and even though it's the same film, they're so different just watching the two versions.
Oh, yeah, it would be, absolutely.
Mm.
And that's the other thing, too. I saw where Night Watch and Day Watch, the Russian films. If you get the Blu-ray version, the plots are totally different than the DVD version, because I think I've got the American DVD version, and it's a weird cut that leaves out a whole bunch of subplots that are really interesting. So, it's almost an hour shorter.
Well,
so Blu-ray, I recommend.
I mentioned just briefly... while we're having the break, of Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Mm.
I'm a big fan of that movie. I've actually got three different versions of that on... Well, I think I got rid of one DVD, because that was like an hour. It was an hour and a half, whereas the full edit of the movie is about just over 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd cut out so much. And that was the first DVD. I thought, grab that. And it was a Singapore DVD release or something that.
Yeah, okay.
So what the?
But you got to be careful.
Yeah, you get somebody will re-edit something, whether it's they'll re-edit it for. And I mean, director's cuts have been a big thing for ages. I think I've only ever seen the one director's cut, which was director's cut of Picnic at Hanging Rock, which was actually shorter than the theatrical release.
The only thing I remember about Picnic at Hanging Rock is the larger chick going around screaming Miranda through the rocks.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't remember anything else about it. I saw it when it first came out and I thought, what the fuck is this movie about? It was very much messing with my head in a dull way, and I thought, no, this isn't interesting at all. There are all these uptight people running around the bush.
Yeah, well, when Peter Weir recut it for the director's cut, I think it was actually only about 5 minutes, but he actually came in shorter mm-hmm. than the original theatrical release, whereas, you know, 95% of the time the director wants to put back more stuff.
He wants to resurrect his babies, kind of. Yeah.
I think somebody was asking Ridley Scott about a director's or yet another version of Blade Runner.
Okay.
There was the theatrical release. He's done his director's cut. I'm sure it was.
There are about six or seven cuts. I know I did it for the radio, and there are just so many cuts, it's hard to keep it straight. You'd need like a terabyte hard drive.
Yeah.
To keep every different cut of Blade Runner.
You want a scorecard with, you know, who's got what and which bit got taken out and what's been.
You'd have to spreadsheet the sucker just to keep it straight, yeah.
Just about, yeah.
But and I'm not even sure it's worth it, because I think that one of the big problems with Blade Runner is that there's an emptiness at the middle of it, which is Sean Young and Harrison Ford. I don't think the characters are characters. I think they're kind of, you know, something to be pushed around by the plot, in a sense, and I don't think that either actor is really strong in the film.
Mm.
Well, we can disagree about it.
I was going to say, I'd have to really sit down and think about it and go, I don't know. So, yeah.
No, well, that's what this is all about. Nobody has to agree all the time.
Oh, look, no.
But, that's the other thing I was going to say, too, is that one of the things I found out recently is, if you want to get good action films and you want to enjoy good action films and modern stuff, and we're drifting out of the paleo cinema here into modern stuff, I don't mind a bit, French action films at the moment kick the ass of anywhere else in the world, Hollywood included. They are just so sharp and tight and interesting that you really can't fault them.
Okay, yeah. The Hollywood action movie has been by the numbers for so long.
Way too long, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, that sort of, you know, insert explosion here, insert, you know, buddy bromance with something. And if we can tie in, you know, a single parent, so much the better.
Yeah, you do get a bit of that. It's all kind of by the numbers. It's like, almost like they've got some software that says, okay, well, you know, it's like, yeah, you put in, okay, what do we want here? We want a character here. What are we going to get? We're going to get a black sidekick, or are we going to get the super bright, white, geeky guy, probably Scottish sidekick? Yeah, those kind of things. But the French ones, they take it from, it's almost like, rather than from the top down, from the studio level down, a lot of the French action films seem to come from the street up. Mm. They find out what people on the street are doing. And have you seen Empire of the Wolf with Jean Reno?
No.
It's got this great subplot right near the start of the film where they've got a Parisian housewife who falls over and has a bit of a head injury.
Mm-hmm.
And then she wakes up in hospital and the doctors tell her that she's had extensive plastic surgery and facial reconstruction, and she's probably Romanian, and she doesn't remember anything about being a Romanian person. She's been given a whole new life story by this new process. And she goes into hospital for a minor thing and finds out that her whole life is a lie. And it's beautifully done. And this is just the start of the film.
I was going to say, this is not the one they based that... they did the Gina Davis Long Kiss Good... Long Kiss
no, no, this postdates that, but this one's got some beautiful bits in it. And the reveal is gradual on what's happened.
That's the other thing that I suppose, you know, you get a lot of, French or... I think Japanese horror movies or Korean horror movies seem to be the current picking stable, but they'll get these other ones and then remake them for Hollywood, and you're going, why?
Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I believe the Finches movie is good, but I kind of like the original. I like the fact that they did a limited budget. They got local actors. They didn't try to get people from other countries to play.
And that's probably the thing with the French action cinema, is because, you know, you're working on a limited budget. You're effectively doing, even though it's professional cinema, you're effectively doing indie cinema just to get the people doing it, getting the writers to do it. It's like, you know, come on, we're going to come up with something new, rather than some bloke sitting around a boardroom table going, so what can we, you know, remake this week?
Yeah, I think one of the other things too is in French cinema, what I understand of it is that people there are more engaged with their local culture, whereas in Hollywood, people are engaged. If you're working in Hollywood, you're engaged in Hollywood as a culture.
Yes.
Yeah, you live in LA, or you can get to LA very quickly. You're involved in that world, which is not a bad thing. I mean, you probably learn a lot. It's a very kind of hothouse environment. But I think in France, the people who make movies are also going to see plays and concerts and reading books. Yeah.
I was reading an interview with Scarlett Johansson this week, and because she has moved back to New York apparently. And she was saying, yeah, she just, you know, wasn't connecting with the LA thing. She said, you know, it's great to go and visit and do your movies there or whatever, but she said, I just couldn't connect to it.
Yeah, it's kind of like eating junk food all the time, in a sense.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, so that's interesting. And things like, I was reading about Bill Murray, speaking of Scarlett Johansson, who did, you know, a movie with Bill Murray. He spent 2 years in France just learning how to speak French and living there and just embracing a new culture. Okay. So, you know, yeah, people don't expect that of somebody like Bill Murray.
No.
They expect goofy stuff. But he really did, when he became famous and he had a little bit of spare time and he had a little bit under his belt, went to somewhere where he could learn.
Because even, I mean, when he started doing, yeah, I mean, he'd done all his goofball comedy things.
Mm.
And then he really started sort of pulling back and saying, okay, I want to do something. It doesn't have to be a dramatic role, but I want to try and do something serious.
He did a very bad version of Razor's Edge, well, a remake of the Tyrone Power movie Razor's Edge.
But yeah, things like that Lost in Translation, and he was doing stuff like that. That it's not, I suppose it's not Academy Award winning stuff. That's going to be there, but you know, he said, well, I want to do something different.
Yeah, I mean, I even like him in The Life Aquatic. A lot of people don't like that movie. But I went along for the ride. And I kind of like the fact that it's got that kind of magic realism touch to it as well. And the fact that he's playing a bit of a different character, and he's got people like Seymour Cassell in the movie and really interesting actors around him, which I think is great. One of the mistakes to get made with the Hollywood comedies is you get your stars and then you get the usual suspects around them as the supporting characters. Good actors, good jobbing character actors, but you see the same ones saying the same kinds of roles.
Mm.
And I think that weakens it. But when you get people who are interesting, you go, oh, I remember that guy from 20 years ago. He was fantastic. And Seymour Cassell, as an actor, you know, did John Cassavetes movies in the 70s and things like that, really did kind of start out as a very, very fine actor, and he brought that to a relatively small role in there. And, you know, it's just that rich stew of things in a movie that makes it interesting. If you know anything at all about films, you've got those extra layers of flavor almost, like a stew.
Yeah, yeah.
And having interesting actors doing interesting things and maybe stepping out of their comfort zone. I mean, Red State, a lot of people complain about Kevin Smith's Red State. One of the good things about it is showing how fucking good actors John Goodman and Michael Parks are. I mean, the movie itself is flawed for a lot of reasons. Structurally, it's got a few problems.
Mm.
But there are two really good roles for two actors of a certain age there. And Goodman and Parks really did bring their A-game to it and show how really, really fine they are at what they do.
And you know, certainly in Goodman's case, you know, he's had that whole, you know, are you the fat, funny bloke, that he's been... I suppose, well, you know, not so much typecast, but...
Well, burdened with, yeah.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, yeah, because it's really hard for him to get anything other than that, because nobody writes, you know, much in the way for a role or for, you know, whether if you are writing a role where the character is either you don't care, so you can cast an actor who's a big bloke, or if you've written it specifically because you need a big bloke as the actor... 9 times out of 10, you know, he's sort of the jolly chap or something like that. So,
Yeah, and I think he's lost a lot of weight too, and because of that, he was obviously so immensely large. He's got that kind of saggy skin look about him.
Yeah.
And it really worked well in this particular role. You know, he was a veteran FBI kind of guy,
mm-hmm.
and you know, had the background in it and had a certain wisdom that came with experience. So it worked really well for the character to be like that. And, yeah, I mean, he's an actor I've got a lot of time for. I mean, Barton Fink, he was just a force of nature in Barton Fink. He was Joe Dante's Matinee, which is a fantastic thing where he's playing a kind of William Castle-type character. But, yeah, I mean, interesting actors doing interesting things is why we go to the movies, really, I suppose. I mean, you can go there for the spectacle of an action summer action film in the US, winter action film for us.
Mm.
But I really think that seeing interesting people doing interesting things in cinema, or going back into old stuff and seeing really interesting things. I saw Brighton Rock with very, very young Richard Attenborough, 1947. Fucking terrific thriller.
What was the one? The Robin Williams one?
Not Insomnia or One Hour Photo?
1 Hour Photo.
Yeah.
And that one, that freaked me.
Mm.
Because, you know, you see Robin Williams effectively switched off.
Mm.
I was just like, holy crap.
You're a really good actor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I mean, you know, because you see him, you know, he does his normal comedy stuff, or if you see him do his stand-up gigs, and he's on.
Yeah.
And to see him capable of doing something like that,
mm-hmm.
And it's just really amazing that, and I think, that was sort of half the reason why that film had the creepy feel that it did, not just because of the plot, but also because you're seeing somebody who so used to being the sort of, you know, the and he's dead.
Yeah.
As sort of, you know, emotionally as a or not so much dead, but it's just it's all held inside, and you're just going, ooh.
Yeah, and that's a lovely thing, and that's another part of the cinema experience, watching those films that you might not otherwise watch because they've got somebody in them you know.
Yeah.
And then seeing them do totally different stuff. Small films are the kind of thing that's saving Hollywood, in a sense.
Yeah, and that's something I find, I suppose, really annoying, that you get actors, or not so much actors, you get fans who will go, oh, you know, he wasn't doing his, you know, blah, blah, blah shtick, or, you know, she wasn't blonde in this movie again. Oh, yeah. So, you know, you should be going along, if you like them as an actor, you should be going along to see them actually do something that's acting, not just walking through the numbers again.
Yeah, and I think that for actors who are actors rather than just in it to keep their name in the headlines.
Celebrities.
Celebrity actors, in a sense.
Yeah.
Doing those things outside their comfort zone. I mean, even someone like Kirsten Dunst, who's had problems with booze, doing Melancholia. I'm looking forward to seeing that because apparently she does do interesting work in that. And I think that she does have chops as an actor.
Yeah.
And that maybe this is the kind of, you know, second part of her career.
Yeah.
Where she was the young, you know, kid in Interview with a Vampire, went on to do the Spider-Man things, had a
train
in her career, and then she's moved on.
Yeah, I mean, she's certainly had a, pardon me, she's certainly had I suppose, the brush with the girly movies, if you like. Mm,
yeah.
But she's also done, you know, quite a few things that would be considered, you know, hard acting stuff.
Yeah, and so. I like that. I like people who take the chance and who are willing to kind of go the distance on things. There's no use doing the same stuff repeatedly, even though it is incredibly lucrative. I mean, Jim Carrey tried to get outside that shtick, but the shtick was so powerful, it drew the gravity of a dream back in. And his best thing he could do now is probably give up movies for a while
and
guest spots on TV.
Well, I was going to say, I think Eddie Murphy is probably another one who's really trying hard to find something that will move him past the shtick,
yeah.
But it keeps coming back to haunt him.
I think so, and I think one of the problems there with Eddie Murphy, he did all those kiddie movies for the money.
Yeah.
And the up and growing people growing up now, seeing him as a guy who was in that cute kid movie or who dressed in a fat suit.
Yeah.
And they don't see the, you know, the early kind of Saturday Night Live Eddie Murphy, who was edgy and interesting.
You've got to go down the Nicolas Cage if you're doing movies for money, you just you grab half a dozen really crap sort of pseudo fantasy things and just do them.
Yeah, and I mean, Nicolas Cage is interesting because his career's an ongoing, interesting train wreck.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and Drive Angry.
Yeah. I was going to say, him and Robert Downey Jr. Yeah, sort of ups and downs. And so, because I think Nick Cage did the Sorcerer's Apprentice, which I didn't actually mind.
I didn't mind it too much.
The Wicker Man, which I loathed.
Oh, absolutely. I watched the original after I saw that.
Ghost Rider. Oh, no, it was after Ghost Rider. Ghost Rider was part of the I've just sold my soul to the IRS.
Mm.
Although I think, is he in the next one?
Yeah, have you seen the trailer for it?
I've seen a poster, but I haven't actually seen the trailer for it.
Oh, it's great, because in the trailer he pisses fire. And you think, I'm going to see that movie just in case he pisses fire in the movie. It's one of those great selling points where you go, okay, that makes logical sense. When he's a ghostwriter, his whole head's on fire.
Yeah.
If he needs to take a slash, he's going to start a bushfire.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, we've probably got to round this up.
All right.
Now, Paul. It's been great getting you on finally, mate. I've kept a promise to you, and I'm really happy that I've done it, particularly this time of year. Thank you very much for coming on. We will get you back. And you have a good time over the holidays and a safe one.
You too.
Okay, thanks, mate.
Look forward to chatting again.
We will be chatting again, absolutely. Now, after this, I'm going to be playing another one of the things I did for the radio, which I've got to play, but... Thank you very much, Paul. And people, leave your feedback at the usual places. And if you want Paul to come back, make lots of encouraging noise and I'll forward him the emails. Okay, take care, mate.
You too. See you later.
See you later. Just want to add a quick bit here saying happy holidays to all of the other podcasters around. Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Writer and a Critic, Shooting the Pooh, Galactic Suburbia, Hammockers Podcast, The B-Movie Cast, Girls on Film, Action Attraction, and anybody who I've forgotten because it is getting quite late here. Have a great Christmas break. If you're up in the Northern Hemisphere, stay warm. If you're down here, stay cool. And now I'm going to play the second of the radio gigs that Iva has sent me for the ABC Local Radio in Darwin thing. Catch you later.
Films with Frost. Terry Frost.
An exciting night with Terry Frost ahead of us, I'm telling you, because I love this film. Good evening, Terry.
Good evening, Ivor.
How are you, my man?
I'm doing fine down here, and we've got a great film to talk about tonight.
An absolute ripper, and it's called?
The Young Girls of Rochefort.
And it's nothing like the title would suggest.
It's not an adult movie.
No, it is one of the best-looking films I've ever seen. And I'm saying that in all honesty and truthfulness. It is such a beautiful-looking film. It is astonishing. The costumes are just fabulous. The sets, the wonderful, the people in it are all, without exception, beautiful looking. Boys and girls, they're all just smashing looking people.
They are. It's just one of the most joyous films that I know. It's really funny because the films that I find most kind of life-affirming and wonderful fun to watch are all French films. Jacques Tati's comedies and things like The Young Girls of Rochefort. It stars Catherine Deneuve and her sister Francoise Dorliac, George Takiris, who people might remember from West Side Stories in it as well, and Gene Kelly, and of course Danielle Darrieux, one of the great actresses of French cinema, is in there as the mother of the twins played by Catherine Deneuve and Francoise Dorliac.
Well, the funny you should say the West Side Story, George Takiris thing, because the beginning is very much, the dancing sequence at the beginning is very much a West Side Story kind of look, isn't it?
It is. It takes place on what's called a transporter bridge, which is a bridge where the roadway moves from one side of the bridge to the other. And people just kind of go on there. It's a bit like a car ferry without the water underneath it. And it's a beautiful evocative way to start the film, with all these carnies coming in to put on a show in Rochefort over a summer weekend, and they're all getting out of the car and stretching while they're on the transporter bridge and just kind of doing everything in slow motion. And it's got a beautiful feel that it puts you into another world, because they're being transported in a very unusual piece of transport into the town. And it kind of sets you up for this world that the director Jacques Demy creates, which is a world of beauty and spontaneous dance and singing and people looking for love and mourning for lost loves and looking for their ideal love and all these sort of things that normally would be a bit saccharine, but in this film are really kind of beautiful and eye-poppingly lovely.
Eye-poppingly lovely is true. Let's have a listen to the Le Pont Transpondeur, which is when they, the opening of the film, just a little bit of music from it. Might just talk over this and leave it playing behind us, because this really sets the scene. I'm sure that we can all figure, even if you haven't seen this film, the style of dancing that's going on when this music is playing.
The music by Michel Legrand is amongst his best. He just finished another movie with Jacques Demy a couple of years before, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, where all of the dialogue in the whole film is sung by the characters. And this one a little less so, but still a lot of singing of character development in a way. But the whole film, I just sit and play the music sometimes just to kind of kick back and feel good, because it's lovely evocative music. And I don't really find it a problem that I don't speak French and I've got to read the subtitles when I see this film either. I think the emotions of the music carry me through the lack of knowledge of the French language.
Well, it's interesting, because in the first 10 minutes of the film, the dialogue is set up here, okay, mm-hmm. okay, and that's all that is said for the first 10 minutes, and everything else is done with dance and movement.
Absolutely. The guy's getting off the truck and setting up the carnival, going past the cafe where Yvonne, the mother, owns, being in the town square, setting up the sense of place for most of the action in the film. And kind of a beautiful moving camera by the cinematographer Ghislaine Coquette, really kind of having a beautiful style about it, and very long shots. And they actually painted parts of the town with bright colours. Normally it was just kind of a kind of off-white coloured town, but they'd paint shutters and fire hydrants and all sorts of things, really vivid pastel colours to kind of give it an otherworldly feel, and to set up the fact that people are going to be dancing in beautiful costumes here.
And the costumes are contemporary 60s mini dresses and jeans, but in pastel colours. You said, let's give an outline here. It's kind of like a farce where people keep missing each other, and even though that we know that in the end everything's going to work out and they'll all get together, they just keep missing each other all through the film. The lovers that don't actually link, and that each one loves the other one, and they don't even know each other, but because of the way their ideal man and their ideal woman, their paths keep crossing almost. It's just so very clear. It's a bit like Brian Rix's farces from England, you know, that one door opens and someone walks through, and then someone comes in through another door and they say, "Where's George?" And, "Oh, you've just missed him," sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, it's lovely the way they do it, and the way that all the plot lines nail together. There's a sailor from the Navy called Maxence, played by Jacques Perrin, a very famous French actor now, and he's a poet and a painter apart from doing his national service. And he paints a picture of his ideal woman that happens to look like Delphine, the character played by Catherine Deneuve, and the picture hangs in the art gallery of her lover, but he doesn't get to see her at all in the film, which is really lovely. They keep crossing paths and things like that. There's a strong indication at the end that they're definitely going to meet, which is a lovely
That's
little
right.
grace.
It's a lovely little thing, isn't it? Yeah, lovely.
It is. And Solange falls for the Gene Kelly character, Andy, an American songwriter and composer who has a friend who's got the unfortunate name of Monsieur Dame, which is a bit like being called Mr. Mrs., and played by Michel Piccoli, a very famous French actor. They meet up there, and nobody knows that Monsieur Dame has a history with the family and all this sort of thing. There are all these little bits and pieces of people not meeting up, but everybody's wonderfully alive and wonderfully capable of finding love, but just not kind of getting there until towards the end of the film. It's a lovely, lovely film.
It sure is. Well, look, there's a great trick in it. Because the plot is, as you probably get, quite complicated, and there's this great montage where the characters are singing. Each couple are actually singing, and they swap lines, and the scene changes. So you get the Solange character singing about her ideal man and what she wants, and then you get her ideal man, which is the sailor, singing about his ideal woman, and then you get Monsieur Dame singing about, you know, and it's a very clever way to actually bring the story together and to say, this is what we really want. This is how the story is really going to go, but you won't find out about it until the end, because that happens about, I don't know, about 40 minutes in, when they just, and it's a very clever ruse to actually make a montage of these people just telling you where they've been and where they want to go.
Yeah, the cross-cutting really works well in that. And the fact that everybody in this film, right down to the old guys sitting in the cafe, are incredibly charismatic people. And you want the best for them. They're attractive. They're singing their hearts out. They're singing about their hearts. And you want the best for all of them. And it really, this movie, I don't know how it does it. I'm going to have to analyze it one day. But it creates a world full of people that you really wish well for.
Yeah, you're
dead
right.
You want them to get what they need to have. Part of it is the direction, of course, and painting the town. The music by Michel Legrand takes you into it. And there's nothing like these films, the Umbrellas of Cherbourg in this one, even though Demi was very much influenced by MGM musicals, and particularly West Side Story and things like that, which use urban settings as the stage in a sense. Really, these films stand alone. There is nothing quite like them. There was a pastiche of this done by Flight of the Conchords in their TV series. There's a song called Fou de Fafa, which is a pastiche of a Jacques Demy musical.
Oh.
And I killed myself when I saw it. It's just a beautifully done pastiche with everyone in pastel shirts in a park and singing in French. And
oh, great.
Bits and pieces. It's just a lovely tribute to them.
You don't know, happen to know who the designer and art director were, or the, do you in this?
I haven't got the art director. I know a lot of it was done by Demi and his wife, Agnes Varda. Demi died in 1990, unfortunately, of an AIDS-related illness. And Agnes Varda was a movie maker in her own right, mostly a documentarian. And him and her collaborated a lot on the works. And she's the person that's restored these films to looking really good.
And boy, does it look
and things
good.
Like that. So I know they collaborate with them. There tended to be everybody getting in, throwing in ideas. Demi had his clear vision of what he wanted. It just came together beautifully. Everything in there just really works. Even the little things like the studio where the two sisters teach singing and dance. Just the little bits and pieces. It's very kind of sparsely decorated set, but it's got a trumpet here and a banjo there, and all sorts of little pieces like that.
And a
that.
Banjo, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, everyone needs to learn the banjo.
That's exactly right. With regard to that, to the Spartan set, the cafe, a lot of the action happens in the cafe, which is in the town square. That cafe is a myriad of reflection. Everywhere you look, there is a totally clean, shiny surface that would have been a nightmare to shoot, because you can't, and I was looking in all these reflective surfaces to see if I could spot the camera. Even the countertop is made of chrome steel, and it's not stainless steel, it's chrome. Everywhere you look, the walls have gold foil on them. Half of the walls are glass, and at night they do, there's a shot at night, there's a scene at night, and you honestly, it must have been a nightmare for them to actually do it. But boy, is it pretty. The art direction in this film is just magnificent, I think.
Yeah, and I think that every new coffee shop in the newer parts of Melbourne was influenced by the design of this one. They've all got that kind of blonde wood, lots of glass, kind of open space feel about them, with funny lights hanging down and all of that. It's a really influential look, and I think that a lot of people who've designed since then have been influenced by that. I don't recall seeing too much like it before this in film, at least. And it's right on the town square too. Everything else is around the edge of the town square, but this little cafe, for some reason, sits right on the town square itself on the pavement. And it's in a totally modern style, which is totally different than the style of the town around it.
Well, there's another thing in this film which is quite shocking, I imagine, to modern day audiences. When somebody that they'd never met before, two guys from a carnival walk into the cafe, and the cafe owner says, "You guys can go and pick up my 10-year-old son from school." So two strangers turn up at the school to pick up this kid. To today's sensibilities, that would never happen. But then it just shows also the age of innocence that was around then, even though it was the 60s and the swinging 60s and, you know, there was a lot of pot and LSD and stuff. There was still a kind of innocence around where two strange guys just came into town, came into the cafe for a coffee, and they go off and pick up a 10-year-old boy.
Boo Boo, his name is. Boo-boo. I love the name of the kid, Boo Boo.
Boo Boo,
and he's just a normal little kid acting up every time he can.
Yeah,
and conning the guys into giving him candy and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, fabulous.
Even the kid's charismatic. You want the best for the kid. You hope he gets the candy.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? You were dead right about that. You do want the best for all of them. A lot of people would say, "Oh, I don't know about a foreign film. Oh, I don't know about a French film. I don't know if I want to see that." I can tell you that categorically, it is one of the best looking films you'll ever see. The story is fantastic. The performances are brilliant. And even though it's a musical, somehow the music, when they start singing their dialogue, it doesn't jar at all. After the first time it happens, it all seems to be perfect. It seems, well, obviously, that's the only way that you would do this. Let's have a listen to a bit of dialogue sung. You sent me this clip. Set the scene for this clip.
This is the one where Delphine is arguing and ends up breaking up with her lover, the art gallery owner, Guillaume, played by Jacques Roubirov.
Ah, dommage, il vient de quitter Rochefort. Il est à Paris pour quelque temps. C'est absolument pas le genre de type qu'il te faut.
Mais que sais-tu de moi, toi qui parles si bien, toi qui dis me connaître et pourtant ne sais rien, 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 rien. Que sais-tu de mes rêves et de quoi ils sont faits? Si tu les connaissais, tu serais stupéfait. Tu ne sauras jamais.
Tu sais bien que je sais pourquoi me contredire.
Tu ne sauras jamais pourquoi j'aime sourire, rire, 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 rire. Tu ne sauras jamais pourquoi j'aime danser, pourquoi j'aime passer mon temps à rêvasser. Pour toi, je ne suis rien qu'une poupée de plus. Je me demande encore ce qui en moi t'a plu. Tu trouves mes propos plats et incohérents. Que je sois triste ou gaie, te laisse indifférent. Jamais, jamais tu ne te poses la moindre question. Tu te moques de moi pour un oui, pour un non, 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 non. Tu dis aimer l'argent encore plus que toi-même. Et moi, où suis-je alors quand tu dis que tu m'aimes? Si tu m'aimais vraiment,
à quoi bon répéter ce que je t'ai redit?
Si tu m'aimais vraiment autant que tu le dis, 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 dis. Quand tu m'as assez vu, soupirerais-tu en disant: excuse-moi, le temps c'est de l'argent. Mais le temps, mon ami, pour moi c'est de l'amour. C'est rire, c'est chanter tant que dure le jour. C'est aimer chaque nuit que le Seigneur a faite. Le temps c'est de l'amour, vivre c'est une fête. Alors, n'espère pas devenir mon amant. Tu mens lorsque tu parles de tes sentiments. Non, 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 non. Reprends ta liberté de fille en liaison.
That was Catherine Deneuve miming for another singer, and Jacques Roubirov in The Young Girls of Rochefort.
With Terry Frost and Ivor Cole on After Dark, ABC local radio right across the territory. As always on a Thursday night, we're blessed with his presence. Well, Terry, we should kind of set a little bit of the story. Monsieur Dame had an affair and fell in love with this woman, Yvonne, who he has lost contact with and believes that she ran off to Mexico. He thinks that there was a child involved. That's one story. You do the next one.
Okay. The sisters, Delphine Solange, teach ballet and music for a living in Rochefort, and both of them want to go to Paris and extend their careers. Solange doesn't have a boyfriend, but Delphine is hooked up with this very egotistical art gallery owner who is basically using her for her body. They meet up with a couple of friendly carnies who come into town on this one weekend with the fair in town, Etienne and Bill, played by George Chakiris and Grover Dale, who kind of, you know, get involved with their lives without being romantically involved with them necessarily. There's some lighthearted flirting, but they're not really into it apart from the fact that they're pretty girls and why not flirt with them and see where you can get. And they hang out in the cafe and meet Yvonne, the mother. They meet Monsieur Dame at one stage and Maxence, the lovelorn sailor. The carnival happens and the girls that they have to do some dancing and singing and dancing at the carnival decide to run off with some sailors. So Etienne and Bill get the two girls, Delphine and Solange, to do an act for them as part of the fair. And everybody comes together, and it does end happily.
That's right. Well, the sequence in the fair where the twins, the non-identical twins, are doing it is very reminiscent of Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
It is. They've even got the kind of sequins and the sparkles.
They
and
do.
Things like that. And one of the interesting things in that scene is they have bareback dresses, and you can see that, like in one of the songs they sing, they've both got identical birthmarks.
Yes, and that's part of the gig, because they have a birthmark which would tell them who their father was.
And there are a lot of references to other films, and of course there's Gene Kelly, who in this film was in his mid-50s, but looked very good in spite of a slightly awkward toupee.
Yes, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was in great nick. He was singing and dancing. He obviously loved what he was doing in this musical, because that kind of exuberance and that physicality that Gene Kelly always brought to his dancing.
Well, he was surrounded by beautiful people. When you were talking about the two carny guys and the chicks, there's a sort of tongue-in-cheek, are these two guys gay?
Actually, in real life, they were.
In the movie, it just hints at that like when they're flirting with them, one of the things they say is, we want to sleep with you. But then the two guys look at each other and sort of go, yeah, right, you know. And there's this overtone of maybe, because it was the swinging 60s, maybe they thought, oh, we can sort of push the envelope here a little bit and say a gay couple in it, which would have been radical for the time in 1967, let's be honest.
I think it was one of those subtext things that the gay people in the audience might have picked up on at the time, which is really good. The interesting thing is Grover Dale, the guy who played Bill, had a long-time affair with Anthony Perkins.
We're almost out of time. I can't thank you enough for sending me a copy of this. I know it's been restored, right, digitally restored or whatever, but it is one of the most, I've said it five times, haven't I? It's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen. And if you're a female knocking around now and you wanted to have a look at some fantastic fashion, which is right at the height of fashion at the moment, this film, you can't go past it. The quality of the wardrobe is astonishing. The make on these clothes, especially the women's clothes, is just perfect. There is, I don't know how they did it, but no matter how much these people move in these clothes, not a wrinkle appears. It is just fantastic. Every seam is perfectly straight. The colours are just phenomenal. I'm blown away. You know, when you told me it's a French musical, I was thinking, oh my God, French musical. But I'll go with him because he knows what he's talking about, and you proved you do.
Yeah, I recommend people find this film. It has been released in Australia on DVD. And if you can import the soundtrack as well.
After waxing lyrical over this film, what are we going to do next week, Terry?
I thought we'd go back to Michael Caine for a little bit, if you don't mind, and do the Yip file, the spy movie.
Back to Michael Caine.
Yeah, I don't think we'll do too many more Michael Caines for a while, but I think doing the Ypres file, which is a very interesting spin on a 1960s spy movie, might be right up our alley.
Look, thank you for tonight, Terry. Smooth sailing down there in Melbourne.
Thank you very much, and keep your powder dry up there.
Thanks, mate.
Chill out for Films with Frost. Terry Frost.
Terry Frost will be with us again next Thursday evening with Michael Caine and the Ipcress File. Stay tuned. There will be more.